Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'm inviting you again to tune in to this discussion and interview that we're going to have with our adventurer, who we've had on the show before, Ajahn Boris, about his book, Whispers of the Himalaya, and also his great adventures as a meditation teacher and meditation practitioner, and what it all means, and what's happened. So, Ajahn, I'm so glad for you to be back on Energy Stew.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's just wonderful to be here, and I appreciate your invite to come back.
Well, this is an important understanding, because so many people project what would happen to them if they really got into meditation, if they did what you did, you know, even go up to the Himalayas and find a cave and meditate for a month at a time. And what would life become? What would change? How self-realized can you be? Can you answer that?
Well, that's a big question. And of course, it's going to be different for everybody. But one thing there, and there's a lot of dimensions to this, because first off, when you do a lot of meditation, it does have a profound effect on your physical body, and therefore also on your mind and your just your mental outlook, your inner experience. So one thing meditation is great at, and if you do a lot at it, you'll really notice a huge change, is that you will get happier. And it's just like, because it affects the body in that way. It's like, you know, if you, for instance, if you're depressed, there's a whole biochemistry that correlates with that. And that's why they know if they can, you know, maybe try to synthetically adjust that biochemistry by giving you certain medications, that you won't feel so deeply depressed. So that's just an example of how biochemistry and the mind correlate. Well, when you do a lot of meditation in a retreat like this, the body flushes a lot of toxins. You know, different things are happening in your brain and your neurochemistry and biochemistry, such that you're going to feel lighter, you're going to feel happier. It's like, and especially if you are in a long retreat like this and you take silence, that even adds a further dimension to it. That just kind of turns on this internal light of happiness and joy. And so it's changing your whole biochemistry, it's changing your whole mental outlook. You become much happier and a sense of well-being. So that you can definitely achieve simply by taking a retreat. Even a weekend retreat, you can accomplish a lot of that. It's not necessary. So what happens when you do a longer retreat is just more stuff comes up. And as you know, if you read the book, you'll see a lot of that. It can even be induced by the situation. In my case, it was very cold living in that cave. You know, you had to overcome the distaste for getting dirt in everything that you owned, for never being, you know, fully clean, for, you know, the fear of maybe scorpions crawling around your cave and beetles. And so it sort of evokes, it plays on different fears and triggers that you may have, little attachments to your normal comforts and pleasures. All this starts to come up and be purged in this situation where you're intent on just going deep within and experiencing and merging in your source, you know? So, and how much of that merging takes place and how thoroughly you imbibe that and integrate that, so that when you come out from your cave and you know, finish your retreat, is really gonna be, you know, an individual matter. And all you can say for sure is that there will be an effect, and it will be a good effect. And it may take you years to really integrate everything that you get from a big retreat like that. So I can say that when I came out of there, I was I was really transformed in a lot of ways, and yet a lot of integration still remained to take place and is still taking place to this day. And we talked about that a little bit last.
It's life.
In our last interview. Yeah, it's life. And there's no shortcut to wisdom. And, you know, you can get clear, you can get deep, you can get joyful, you can open your chakras and feel more love. But that wisdom also requires, you know, living and experience in the world. And that definitely takes time.
And what we have to accept is that we're all different. The fact that you could even do this in the first place is unusual. Most people can't imagine putting themselves through what you did and even being able to sit in that, you know, lotus position for a dozen hours at a time, perhaps. And,
and,
you know, it's wonderful that you could achieve such blissful states. And I guess there are a lot of people who can eventually become that way. But we're not all designed the same way. And we all have our different ways of experiencing life. And so,
totally.
Yes. And well, you've taught so many thousands of people over the years about meditation, and you've seen so many different personalities handle it.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I also am a student of the Enneagram. If you know what that is, it's a way of looking at the personality. And of course, there are different Enneagram types, and this means different sort of types of personality, what motivates you, how you see the world, and so on. And I'm a five on the Enneagram. The five is the observer. The five is the guy who would be in the cave if anybody would. So not everybody is a five, of course, you know. So it's going to be much harder for some of the other Enneotypes to even contemplate that idea. But everybody can benefit from meditation, and everybody therefore can benefit from retreats. But like I say, for most people, that will look more like a weekend, a 3 or 4 day retreat. It can really produce profound effects. And so this was just a giant, my Whispers of the Himalayas, that was a giant version of a weekend retreat. It was a 2 month retreat, you know.
But you had so many profound experiences that makes the book so enjoyable to read, because you can really be with you going through all of the stressful situations that you had to put yourself through. And then there are some realizations, some opportunities. I love the opportunity at the end of the book where you went to the mouth of the Ganga River and wanted to actually touch the very beginning of it and the ice that flows out of, and you weren't really prepared for the walk home.
And not at all
what happened to you. But what I loved was the resolution to it.
Well, you're bringing up a great story. Actually, it was interesting, you know. Here I'd come from the southern tip of India. I was living in Kerala at the time, which is in the opposite end of the country. So I actually traveled by second-class train, and second-class train in India, it can be pretty rough. I mean, there are no cushion on the seats, just a wood bench. And I did that. It was a three-day plus train ride, plus then a long bus journey of several bus journeys to get up to this source of the Ganga. And then I spent those 2 months in the cave. Well, I wanted to complete that by actually getting to the very source of the Ganga, which is a glacier about 18 kilometers up from, about 20 kilometers actually from my cave, further up the mountains, into the mountains. And so I made that trek. I was going to do it round trip in one day. And I got up to the glacier, and it's just another world up there. It's all ice and barren, you know, windy tundra type with snow and ice. Anyway, so I got up there, and I decided I have to touch that glacier, and there was a fellow with me, and I thought, oh, this would make a great photo opportunity. You know, I could go. There was a there's a cave that the Ganga is flowing out of at the base of the glacier. And at the base of that cave, there was some piles of ice. And I didn't think about how those piles of ice got there. I just thought, oh, I could walk out on those piles of ice and be right in the mouth of this cave. What a great shot that would be. So I started heading for it, and the guy had his camera. And just as I was getting close to the thing, suddenly a huge chunk of ice, the size of like a 1 or 2 car garage, broke away from the top of the glacier and crashed down right where I was walking. And I realized, oh, that's how that ice walk got there from these crashing, you know, huge mountains of ice.
Right, and you could have been under it.
right. So I thought, okay, scratch the walkway shot. And then I decided I still had to touch the glacier. And so I just very gingerly made my way up to the glacier and touched it. And that seemed like quite an achievement. And the guy with the camera thought I was absolutely insane, but I still lived. So that was okay.
And there's a picture in your book from that journey. But I was amazed at was what happened on the way back. That,
oh yeah,
you had to get home because it was so cold and you weren't prepared for the elements.
And, right.
And you also physically had some issue, right?
Yeah, I had not. This was basically a 26-mile hike going up 3,000 feet and, you know, 13 miles up and 13 miles back. That's what it amounted to, all in one day. And I had prepared for this hike not by working out, not even by, you know, taking little daily treks, but rather by sitting in my cave in full lotus, you know, like you say, 12 hours a day. And so my knees were not strong from having had them in that position all the time. My legs were sort of atrophied practically. And so by the time I got up there, I was really feeling it. That was 13 miles. That was really hard on me. And then it started to rain. And in the cold and in the stress on my legs, now my knees started to hurt. This sometimes happens to hikers when you're going down,
right,
the impact of walking down. And it became very extreme, such that every single step was literally as if somebody was driving a nail into your knee, and each of my knees, you know, with each step. And that's not an exaggeration. That is exactly what it felt like. And I had to, and of course I had 13 miles to go, and every step was excruciating pain. And so this became the most difficult physical trial of pain I've ever experienced in my lifetime. And I couldn't keep up with my companion at that time. And so he became impatient because it was going to be getting dark soon. And here we were in the Himalayas in the cold and rain, and it'd be easy to get hypothermia and all that. We could not spend a night out there and live, probably. So this was important to keep going. But I could only go at a crawl, basically. And so I tried to do kind of a walking meditation. I invoked every god and goddess and saint and deity in, you know, in every pantheon of every spiritual culture of the world, and nothing much was easing my pain. And finally, I did have an experience where, you know, the focus of a lot of my meditation is on the formless, infinite self, you know, Brahman. And so I started to repeat a common Mahavakya, they're called. It's just a succinct phrase that succinctly expresses the most profound truth, which is, I am Brahman, and all this is Brahman. And as I was coming down and saying that, and because of the intensity with which I was feeling this pain, and it was kind of propelling my mind in this direction, I soon started to feel this amazing bubble of grace. It was literally like I was almost walking in a bubble of light, and even to the extent of almost being carried down the mountain in this bubble of light. And I found that even though my knees were still hurting, I could walk much faster. And then the pain started to turn into a blissful feeling. And I overtook my friend finally, who had been, you know, long, had really gotten quite a ways ahead of me. And then finally, we, for the last part of it, we walked together. And the interesting thing is, it had turned dark, so we were walking in the dark, and we each had a flashlight. And I had just put new batteries in my flashlight, but they were batteries that you bought in India, which means you just have to cross your fingers and hope they work. Actually, and after a short order, they did go out altogether. And so, I mean, those brand new batteries, they were just gone, no light whatsoever. And then we got a little further and my friend's batteries went dead as well. And so we now found ourselves maybe just a mile or so from our, my cave, and without any light in a pitch black forest. And so that was another thing. And maybe I shouldn't say a spoiler. I'll let you find, read the book and find out how that turns out.
I read the book. And you made
it. We did make it.
I loved it and all the adventures in it. But I was so fascinated by this bubble of grace that you found. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really important for people to believe that they can create that.
Yeah, true. And it completely surprised me. I mean, literally nothing up to that moment had worked in this intense pain. And the funny, there's all kinds of little interesting aspects to this. As we were coming down, I had seen people get donkeys, you know, other people had donkeys. I was really seriously thinking of getting a donkey, but I really couldn't at that point. There was no way. Plus, I was kind of shamed by these porters who were carrying stuff up to sort of little camps further up the mountain. And they would be carrying, like, on their head and on their back, just whole cartons of pop bottles. Like, you know, I don't know, they'd be carrying like 80 or 100 pop bottles.
It's amazing what they carry.
I know. Exactly. And then big jugs of whatever, water, or I don't know.
I always think about them when I'm coming home from a shopping trip. I'm in New York City and I go by foot and I use a backpack. And often it has 40 or 50 pounds in it. And,
right.
And I'm thinking, this is nothing compared to these guys.
I know. They're just amazing. I know. I was, like I say in the book, it seemed to me they must have been yogis in a past life who had developed some incredible cities, you know, yogic powers.
Right.
And maybe misused. And now they had to just carry these things up and down, you know. In any case, I couldn't ask for a donkey when I was seeing these kind of feats in front of my, you know, me. So it was just, there's so many dimensions to the whole experience. And but, like you say, there was a lot of adventure.
But I think what's important about the book is to understand a spiritual path and what it entails. And that it entails challenging ourselves, being challenged by it, being challenged by life in ways that we're all different. We all will take on different strategies and perhaps successes or not, but that there is divine grace. And the more that we can follow that and live in that, the more it reveals itself to us. You had a lot of magic happen to you on this trip, and I'm sure all of your life you've seen magic work, serendipity and synchronicity, in ways that you can't explain other than it's grace.
Totally. Yeah, like you say, in the book, there's a lot of magic in terms of the kind of revelations, and those were the whispers of the Himalayas. Those are the essence of the book for me. But I'll tell you another little story when you talk about magic that kind of blew my mind, honestly. There was a point in the time that I spent in the cave where I had some food in my cave. Most of the time I didn't have any food, but there was part of it where I was storing some food. And
but not that you didn't eat during that period. You would go
to a local
hamlet.
Right. I got a free meal every day. So I had one meal a day, basically. And then after a while, I found I needed a little more. So I took a snack in addition to that. But at another point in the whole thing, I had some food in my cave, and it was causing something to get in my cave, and the food was in a bucket. And something would wrestle around in the bucket. And
I remember this story. Well. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is, and I thought, okay, well, this has got to stop. It's keeping me awake and stuff. So I got to make clear this, whoever this is not welcome. So I had this bamboo walking stick, and I went over to the bucket with my flashlight, and in the middle of the night, and I whapped the side of the bucket, you know, just to give whatever was in there a good scare so it would not keep doing this. And so out of the top of the bucket crawls this sort of, I don't know if it was a rat or a mouse or what. It wasn't that big, so I don't think it was. I think it was a large mouse, basically. And it crawled out, and then it crawled down, and it was on the floor, and it seemed a little stunned and uncertain. And of course, if I had been wanting to, I could have walloped it, but I didn't want to hurt it. I just had wanted to kind of, you know, let it get the message it wasn't too welcome. And so it crawled across the floor of the cave, and when it got right in front of me, it crawled towards me on top of this rock, and it was on top of the rock, and it looked up at me with its unblinking eyes, and then it put its front paws together and, I swear, bowed down. And then it came back up and it looked at me again for a few moments, and then it crawled off the rock and crawled into a crevice in the side of the cave. And I just, that sounds fantastical. I mean, it sounds like I'm got to be making this up. I did not make this up. I am sure there was no circus trainer in the Himalayas training this mouse. This mouse was a miracle. And it showed me that, you know, every being there has, you know, can, you know, has a sanctity. And from that point on, I never again complained about my nighttime forager in my bucket. He kept coming, and he was welcome.
Right. You knew it was a fellow spiritual traveler.
Exactly. And, you know, it's hard to even make sense of. Again, you know, it recalls the whole idea of reincarnation. It was this some yogi that took some misstep and ended up being a mouse, and now he's a very sacred mouse. I have no idea. All I know is what I just described really happened. I'm not making it up. And it was a magical journey in so many ways.
Right. And that's why this book is so fascinating. I'm sure that a lot of people will feel the way I do about it, because it draws us to what our own potential could be. Not that I'm thinking of doing any of that, but just on an understanding of who we truly are when we allow ourselves, you know, to discover more of our oneness and self-realization, that, you know, it's a discovery path that many of us are on in different ways. And, you know, I have my way of doing it that I'm very happy with. And so I'm very grateful that I can speak with you and really appreciate the richness of what you're doing and why, and honor that so much, because, you know, it's a special purpose you have to inform all of us about ourselves through your adventures.
Beautifully put, Peter. I hope that's what it does. And, you know, that's my purpose in writing the book. And that's my prayer, that people reading it get that inspiration, that it helps them in their path somehow.
Right, exactly. And and what I wanted to talk with you a lot about, and this half hour goes by so quickly, so much fun hearing what you have to say. And but I want to get deeper into the purpose of meditation You talked about that early in the show. Mm-hmm. But what it really accomplishes in terms of what our goals are in life, in terms of purpose, certainly, I love that meditation brings peace and clarity to our bodies and minds, our spirit.
Right.
And yet, as we also talked about, everybody is different. And the way that we use that has to align with that deeper purpose of why we've come here to follow the path that we're each following differently.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, your question, kind of the answer is contained in it. And I know that right now is a time where a lot of people are finding their own kind of inner truth and mission and what gives them meaning in life. And they're not necessarily just accepting the idea that 9-to-5 jobs are all where it's at and that kind of thing. So a lot of people are searching for their meaning. So the first thing meditation can do is give you, connect you enough with yourself and give you the clarity that you start to feel your purpose, your dharma. And that is so important. I mean, there's nothing more important. That's why we're here as individuals. And it is your individual dharma. So connecting with your source, connecting with spirit, with the higher self, and then bringing that out in your life, your unique life, and giving it a unique expression.
Well, we can also talk about it related, for instance, to the Enneagram and what mm-hmm. you know about that. You know, I also work with the Human Design System. I work with Destiny Cards. So I'm very interested in who we're born to be and how that plays out in our lives and what we can expect of ourselves because of that. So the different numbers in the Enneagram can help people know more about what to expect of themselves.
Yes, true. Yeah.
And maybe
exactly.
we can talk in the future about how to connect that with the meditative journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would like to give that some thought. I've not heard the question put quite that way. So, but it's a very stimulating idea.
Oh, good. So, and we're getting to the end of the show right now. So, Ajahn Boris and your book Whispers of the Himalaya. And people can find you at ajayan.com, ajayan.com, correct?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yes, and the book is on Amazon, of course. And thank you, Peter. It's always a delight talking to you, and so I hope we get together and talk again.
I hope so, too. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at prn.fm. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.